In the legal world, knowledge is mostly shared through the written word, in briefs and judgments. But true wisdom, that's passed from person to person over time. Welcome to Elephant Echoes, a podcast that provides a platform for Bowman's legal veterans to pass their wisdom to the next generation of lawyers. I'm Bianca Masterton, a knowledge and learning lawyer in Bowman's Johannesburg office. As organizations such as Bowman's grow, evolve, and adapt, there is a risk of institutional knowledge being lost over time. This podcast is inspired by the great elephant herds and their complex and caring social structures. Our most experienced practitioners share their knowledge, skills, and insights as to how to become outstanding lawyers with flourishing practices. In this episode, Andrew Pike, a senior consultant based in Durban, shares how tenacity helped him to become a recognized expert in the ports, transport, and logistics sector.
I do realize that a number of you who've tuned in are not necessarily lawyers, and you'll forgive me for much of my perspective is from a lawyer's point of view. But hopefully whatever I have to share will be of some value to you. I suppose my journey started with charting my own path. And it's a question that we need to ask all of ourselves at one point in time in our lives. And that's kind of, you know, where are we going and what is our purpose in life? And I was quite fortunate when I was at school, standard 7, 8, whatever we call that now, grades 9, 10. I saw a film called 12 Angry Men, which was about a hung jury in America in a criminal trial. And I came out of that absolutely fascinated by the legal process and just knowing in my heart of hearts that this was where I wanted to be. This is what I wanted to do, law. Not that I necessarily thought I might be a criminal lawyer or a ports lawyer or anything, but the purpose overall was to become a lawyer. And so I knew that very early on. And that was quite a bit about trusting my gut. I was very fortunate when I left school. My parents relocated to Windhoek and I spent 6 months with a major law firm there before I went to the army. So I knew nothing. I was just a clerk and I got involved and asked to go and spend 2 months in Swakopmund in a political trial. I was literally just running errands for counsel and the attorney running the case, but it was riveting for me. And by the end of the trial, 2 men had been sentenced to death and 2 women had been sentenced to long terms of imprisonment. And I was quite shattered because I kind of got to know the accused. We were representing the World Council of Churches, or instructed by them, but representing the accused against the state. And I got back to Windhoek and they were convicted, but not yet sentenced. And when the sentence came through on a long telex, I was quite friendly with our receptionist at the office. I used to help her work the telex machine and do the stuff that unqualified clerks do. This woman got a phone call from someone, which I wasn't sort of listening to. It was all in Afrikaans and I kind of wasn't paying attention. And then she took the telex with the sentencing and went and photocopied it, brought back the photocopy, folded it up and put it in her library book. And now my interest was piqued. And she said, can you keep a secret? And then told me this shocking story that she'd been giving every document in the firm's files to the security police. And so they were always a step ahead of the game. And, in this trial, and, you know, our counsel kept saying, but why do they know this stuff, you know, about the prosecutor? And it was because they had all the accused statements and so on in their possession already. So I was suddenly sucked into this spy drama. Just to cut the story short, I eventually blew the whistle on this woman. She had told me that there was another partner in the firm involved, that there was another CA involved, and another secretary, and all hell broke loose when I blew the whistle. The accused were not given leave to appeal, so they were going to hang come what may. As a result of that whistleblower, I had to go and give evidence in a special application for an appeal. And at the end of the day, everyone was acquitted in Bloemfontein because of a mistrial. And the sort of sequel to the story was that when I studied criminal procedure at Wits a couple of years later, this was the case that we studied in relation to the topic of legal privilege. So, you know, it kind of all affirmed that I was on the right path. And a part of finding a purpose is acting completely in alignment with that purpose. So everything that you do once you have that purpose has got to line up with it. And if you kind of step off purpose, you will know very soon. The other part about charting a path is seizing opportunities. And I had many of those, one of which was I was on the Law Students Council at Wits, and I was in charge of education, organizing educational talks. And Weber Wenzel came to give us a talk. And to me, this was a golden opportunity to talk myself up, which I did to the partner who was recruiting. And I got an interview. My marks were not especially good, and I got into Weber Wenzel, which I was thrilled about. And whilst I was there, they said that they wanted someone to specialize in maritime law, because they had no one, and they thought that someone should go to England. And, you know, I knew nothing about maritime law, but this was an opportunity. I'd traveled once overseas, but I put my hand up immediately and went overseas and worked in a firm called Clyde & Co. in London, where I learned a fortune. Then, for political reasons, I didn't want to come back to South Africa, but I was having work permit issues in the UK. And suddenly an opportunity opened up for me in Luxembourg, and I went there and did corporate finance type of work. And there was some company secretarial. And in fact, it was a company called Maitland & Co., which was an offshoot of Weber Wenzel and had been established largely for sort of sanctions busting purposes. You know, and I say that there was nothing unlawful about it, but it was about creating structures which were able to trade around the sanctions against South Africa at the time. You know, when for various reasons I left Luxembourg, I was recruited back to Shepson and Wiley in Durban. And there, once again, I landed up in, you know, what was then the best shipping practice in the country. I think it's fair to say Bowman's is that now, but with the doyen of shipping, a guy called Shane Dwyer. And I started working on huge casualties that we used to have in those days. And one of them, a year after I got there, was called the Oceanus. And the Oceanus was a Greek passenger ship which sank off the South African coast in appalling weather. There was 600 people on board, and they were in serious, serious trouble. What made the story unique in maritime circles was that the captain and senior officers deserted the ship when they knew it was sinking. They never bothered to tell anyone else it was sinking. And so entertainers and non-seafarers had to try and organize a rescue on board. And they put people into lifeboats, launched them into huge seas, sort of gale force winds, 20-meter waves. You know, and when they ran out of lifeboats, there were still 200 people left on board. And then the South African Air Force came and started lifting people off and taking them back to the shore. And it was the greatest maritime rescue in history. Everyone was saved. There were no casualties, a couple of injuries, but it was absolutely astonishing in the circumstances. And again, it was just an opportunity that fell into my lap, and I was absolutely thrilled. And it sort of created a path for me to claim my space as, you know, one of the leading maritime lawyers in the country. Again, sort of after a long time at Shepston's, I decided that I needed to try something else. I'd become very involved or interested in some of my clients' businesses. And eventually, with a couple of clients and friends, we started up a consulting business. So I left the profession in the early 2000s and started up some governance management consulting. I did some training and I did some writing. And, you know, so there I was completely off purpose, in the sense that I'd left the law for a few years. And, you know, there was a financial price to pay for it. You know, governance sort of paid some of the bills, but not all of them. But having said that, I learned an absolute fortune and sort of put myself into a completely new space. After a couple of years, sort of client-driven, I started my own practice again. But I was also invited to sit on the board of the Ports Regulator of South Africa, the newly constituted Ports Regulator, which to Transnet is the same as NERSA is to Eskom. You know, it regulates the ports. And to this day, I remain the only private practice ports lawyer that's ever sat on that board. And so that was 5 years of amazing experience in the ports. And from there, I joined Mark van Velden and later Trudy Nichols joined us. And then, you know, Bowman's took some interest in us, and 10 years later, here I am. It's been an amazing journey, but much of it has been just looking at opportunities, seeing to what extent they align with a bigger purpose, and then taking them. The next thing I wanted to talk about was being a great lawyer. And, you know, I want to suggest that that's something more than the bad rap that lawyers get. You know, and lawyers, some lawyers do have a bad reputation, and I don't think that's us. You know, when I was asked to do this, I had some thoughts about it, and these are the ones that I want to share. The first one is giving real world, practical, truthful, realistic advice. And, you know, some of our clients, and I can name them, but MSC in particular, say that's the only reason they use us, because of the real commercial advice we give and the solutions that we find. Part of that is finding out what clients do, but also, you know, that walkabout of mine into the sort of corporate governance world taught me an awful lot about commercial practice. And so, you know, the part of the message is that clients don't want to hear legalese. They can't stand it. They want solutions, and they don't want to know what the law is. They want to know what they can do within the law. And that's a big piece of being a great lawyer. I also think that good lawyers are curious about everything and are interested. So, you know, it's one thing to be interesting and to think you're interesting, but you aren't always. But being interested in what clients do and being interested in what other people do and finding out how the world works, that to me is what builds your brand in many ways. Authenticity and being in integrity, I think, are a huge piece. If you want to be trusted, you need to be authentic and you need to be in your integrity. And the moment you cross that integrity line, and I've seen it time and again, it impacts on everything. And, you know, you kind of become known as the person that's willing to cross the line. And integrity cuts across everything. It's not just about, you know, not stealing money at work. It's about, you know, being in integrity with your relationships, with yourself, with the world. And it's such a huge piece in building trust. The other thing is sticking to basics. And I say this in a legal context, but I think it applies to everything. But when I went to Clyde & Co in London, I knew nothing about maritime law, absolutely nothing. And I wondered how I was going to deal with this. And I told myself, just keep asking, is it a contract or is it a delict? And, you know, if it's one or the other, what makes it that? And, you know, what are the elements and what does it lead to and how do I deal with it? And funnily enough, that worked for me incredibly well. And it still works for me to this day, is when I'm faced with something really complicated, I get back to what is the basics of this? What are we trying to say here? What are we trying to do? And what is the client trying to achieve? And the moment you go back to basics, you decomplicate everything. I had a principal and mentor, one of the partners at Web Events, or called Nigel Everingham, who's an amazing lawyer, but just such a lovely human being as well. And probably one of the top insurance lawyers in his day. I got much of my formative learning from him. But the one thing that always stuck with me when I asked him one day, what is it that makes a great lawyer? What makes you a great lawyer? He said, well, his principal had said to him, pay infinite attention to detail. And he'd always done that, and that had served him well. And I've kind of followed that, and it's served me well. You know, particularly I've a couple of matters where, for various reasons, I've personally had to go and give evidence in the box. And honestly, once you've been in the box, you have a new form of sympathy for witnesses who are under cross-examination. But what has mostly saved me there has been the detail that I've kept about a case and been able to give evidence relying on that detail. And so that's been a big piece. And I think when you see the fees people pay to Bowmans, if they're not getting detail, I think we're doing them a huge disservice. The detail is not just about typos and things, but that's part of it, typos and grammar. Mayor Giuliani in New York, when there was a huge crime problem, started with the detail. He started cleaning up graffiti and fixing broken windows. And from there, he sort of created that critical mass to start dealing with crime, where suddenly there was a message to the community that, you know, it wasn't okay to have the detail messed up. And I think that's what we're about, you know, is when we take care of the detail, the rest takes care of itself. Finding solutions for clients is a massive piece of what I think we need to do to be decent lawyers. And I think resilience and growth are also a big piece. I've taken my fair share of knocks in court and so on over the years. And I don't know, I take it very personally. And it takes a special strength to pick yourself up after you've taken a hammering in court and say, well, you know, what could I have done differently? What could I have done better? And, you know, what's the growth piece in this for me? And I think we can say that about a lot of stuff. You know, what's the growth piece? Because life very often delivers stuff that you didn't want and didn't ask for, but it came anyway. And to be your best self in that situation, how is it that you're going to learn from that? Great lawyers have to make sacrifices, I'm afraid to say. And for those of you who are Latin scholars, that word sacrifice derives from Latin, two words in Latin, which means to make sacred or to make holy. And that's exactly what we do. When we need to do things and sacrifice other things, we're placing the thing in favor of which we've made the sacrifice above all else. And quite often it is your career, which is not to say, you know, sacrifice the family, but something has to give, and especially in a career where you are selling time. And for me, you know, I sort of slowed down on the sport and, you know, did less of my hobbies. And I suppose all of those things were sacrifices, but ultimately you've got to find some sort of a balance. The last thing that makes a great lawyer is agility. Agility to me is about adapting to change. And there's no one of us that isn't facing change every day. We're faced with AI. In the shipping world, I found that shipping matters were diminishing rapidly in South Africa. And I think any of the shipping partners will attest to that. And that's largely why, you know, my agility got me into ports and logistics, which is strongly related to shipping, but it's not shipping. And it gave me the resilience that I needed to continue with a practice. I think the important question, though, is what do you want to be famous for? And what I'm getting at here is, if you want to be great in whatever you're doing, and whether it's a lawyer or a manager or whatever it is that you're doing, how is it that you're going to distinguish yourself? What will make you stand out from the crowd? part of that is building your brand. And your brand comes from what are your values? What do you stand for? How do you deliver your work? Do you give solutions? That's your brand. But, you know, out of that, there are lots of people who, you know, pay attention to detail and are good lawyers and good technically at whatever they do, but it doesn't necessarily distinguish them. So, you know, my distinction, I think, was in specializing in the ports work and seizing the opportunities that came my way. And, you know, I've built a practice which ultimately came from learning as much as I could about as much as I thought I needed, and exploring the ports world, exploring the corporate world. And I don't think anything is ever wasted. You know, I questioned after my 4 years of walkabout whether that was time wasted. And in fact, it's never been wasted, because although I don't use it on a day-to-day basis, it's all come back to support my practice at some point. And I think the big piece is claiming your space. You know, if you put your hand up and say, I am the one that will lead the way, fly the flag in the ports world, or fly the flag in the HR world, or employment, or wherever it is that you happen to be, and just keep claiming that space until you own it, that is a big piece of building the practice. And then persistence is really, really important as well. And then creativity. I've been really fortunate in the firm to have the support of many people, including the amazing Melissa Deacon. Well, I mean, I want to acknowledge everyone in the KM side of things, not least of all you, Bianca, as well. But, you know, between Mel and I, we've got creative around, for instance, creating this sports newsletter, which is read around the world. And Mel digs and delves and finds every single bit of ports and logistics information in sort of sub-Sahara and collates it and shares it with the rest of the team and then puts it into a digest form. And, you know, that was one creative act which has helped build our brand as ports people. When COVID broke, you will recall that you couldn't import or export anything except strategic cargoes. And the regulations were changing, if not daily, then sort of at least weekly. And they were so poorly drafted that no one knew what the heck was going on. And I had clients phoning and saying, what do we do? Can we export? Do we put it in a warehouse? What happens to this? And I thought, you know, we need a webinar here. And we put together a webinar in very quick time. We probably had 150 or more clients and potential clients who joined that. And, you know, as best as we could interpret those regs, we shared them and shared our thoughts. And honestly, that year was one of the busiest years I've ever had. And largely it sprung off the base of that webinar. And again, it made us famous for logistics and, you know, for being at the leading or cutting edge of that stuff. So it's hugely important. And I think the last thing is, you know, if you want to be famous, make sure that clients understand that they all matter. In 1990, I was at a shipping function in Durban for the whole shipping industry. And I met a short, squat man called Athol Emerton, who was a ship's agent. I knew nothing about ship's agents. I just bumped into this guy and I thought, well, you know, I'm new in Durban. I'm going to befriend this guy. And we started chatting and he was just the most interesting human being. And, you know, I found out a bit about his business and went out for coffee with him, you know, a couple of days later. And I started getting work, and it was sort of small work, what I suppose I'd call rats and mice work. But, you know, as the relationship grew, so the work grew. And ship's agents, as you may know, represent ship owners and sometimes cargo owners. And, you know, over the years, and he's after 30 years, he's one of my best friends. I've built this logistics practice, which much of it has come from learning from him about logistics. This guy knows more about moving stuff around the continent than any other human being on the planet, probably. You know, and he's referred his own clients to us and really been the most incredible source of work, inspiration and friendship. So all of that is part of becoming famous, if you want to call it that, but at least sort of well known in what it is that you do. The other part of this and building your practice is becoming the trusted advisor. So that is where you are building something more than just a client relationship. You're actually becoming the person that the client trusts more than anyone else in the world. And, you know, that same Athol Emerton, he had a function for his own clients or customers a couple of years ago in Johannesburg. And he invited me to it. I gave a talk on the Oceanus. And I sat down. He then addressed his customers. And he started off by saying, there is nothing that I do in my business, nothing, without speaking to Andrew Pike. And that's, you know, was a brilliant kind of accolade in front of all those people, those industry people. But, you know, he genuinely meant it, that I'm the first person he talks to. And, you know, and it's not just about, you know, his business. It's about everything pretty much in his life. So becoming that trusted advisor requires you to learn and understand the entire business. And you have to understand, you know, Rome doesn't get built in a day. There's a process of integration with the customer, with the client. You've got to build trust. And part of that trust building is telling the truth and being in your integrity. But it's also getting to know the human being, getting to know who the wife or the spouse is. Well, you know, what are the kids' names? What do they do? How old are they? You know, I call, you know, the few clients I have who I regard as being their trusted advisor. I will call them out of the blue just for a chat. Just, how are you doing? You know, not expecting work. And sometimes I get work and sometimes I don't. You know, I have them to dinner. I had a partner at Chefson and Wiley who swore that when you've had a client around your dinner table, you will never ever lose them. And I think there's something to that. But, you know, you've also got to add value. But the most important thing about becoming a trusted advisor is that there needs to be some chemistry, and you're not going to be everyone's trusted advisor because you're not going to have chemistry with everyone. So it's about that. And then the last thing, which is what I kind of mentioned earlier about giving real world, truthful, clear advice. The other thing I wanted to talk about was colleagues and partners. And so when I'm talking about colleagues, I'm talking about internal and external colleagues. And the one thing I've come to discover is that when there's a gritty relationship between you and your colleagues, your life is pretty unpleasant. Internal colleagues is the worst because you're spending more time with colleagues than, you know, than with your spouse or significant other generally. And so unless you've got really clean relationships, it's going to be not a lot of fun coming to the office each day. So, you know, if you've got gritty relationships somewhere, clean them up. It's a huge piece of just enjoying what it is that you do. You know, external colleagues, similarly, I've belonged to the Maritime Law Association for many years, and I was the president for a couple of years. And there's a thing amongst shipping lawyers of collegiality where we play hard, we go to an annual conference, but we also fight hard. But it's never with any underlying malice, never with any underlying ego. It's just about getting the job done. So that collegiality is really good. And what works really well is I've found that, you know, one of my biggest clients has become colleagues from internally from Bowman's. But not only that, when other colleagues, you know, outside of the firm have conflicts of interest, a lot of that comes my way. And it's simply because we've got good, clean relationships. And that's a big, big part of the way we need to live our lives, not just with colleagues, but to everyone. The other thing I wanted to talk about was mentors and mentees. So I mentioned a mentor I had at Weber Wenzel. I mean, he made such a difference in my life. I kind of grew in confidence and assurance in what it was that I was doing. I learned a fortune. And you know, he just always had time for me and would make time for me. And I've always been hugely grateful for that. One of my hobbies is photography. I have a mentor in photography and I learn a fortune. I speak to this guy twice a month and, you know, I just keep on learning and growing. And a point in time comes where you kind of know enough to start becoming the mentor yourself. And I think that if we're not passing on the knowledge that we have, we're losing a big opportunity, a huge piece for us in our lives. And, you know, whether it's in our lives in Bowens or our lives at home or whatever, is sharing what we know and doing it in, you know, in a kind way and a way which makes sense and which just gets that institutional knowledge out there. So a huge part of living our lives and my life has been diversifying it. I'm probably one of the busiest people I know, and it's not just with law. I know and have known in my time many lawyers who know nothing beyond the timesheet, and truly some of them have been the most boring human beings on the planet. And, you know, sweet and kind, but just boring. And it's because they have no other interest. And when they retire, they very often die quite soon after that. The diversification is a huge, huge piece. And part of that is finding and living whatever your passion may be. My current passion, as I say, is photography. I love writing as well. And I just find that it rounds me off. It gives me balance in my life. And it helps me escape from the workplace. And it also kind of makes me more effective, I think, in the workplace because I have that balance. I spend time with my family. I do stuff that really feeds me and nourishes me in every way. Staying healthy has been such a big part of my journey, you know, and I've had the odd health challenge along the way. And, you know, when you have a health challenge, you become a burden, not just to yourself, but obviously to others around you. And for me, I've done a lot of exercise in my life. I was a sort of semi-professional sportsman when I was at Wits and in the years after that. And I've obviously tapped back on that just because I don't have time for that. But exercise has been a massive part of my life. Being careful about what I put in my mouth has been really important. And it becomes more and more important as you age because it takes longer and longer to get over stuff. And so, you know, I cannot stress enough, just, you know, that's what when I'm saying being in integrity with yourself, part of that is, you know, being congruent about what it is that you put in your mouth, what it is that you do to look after yourself and take care of yourself. And then another piece for me is about leveraging and sharing what you know. I've learned so much over the last, you know, 40 years of law plus, you know, everything else I've done. And one of the ways that I've shared that is I've written three books. The first one was more of a project that was a research paper that I started for the Institute of Risk Management. And, you know, it kind of grew legs and eventually it turned into a book. So I like saying that I wrote that and published that one by mistake. The second one I wrote was something called The Talking Stick. During the 80s and 90s, I was doing quite a lot of sort of personal growth, self-development work. And just in a moment of inspiration, about 20 years ago, I thought, you know, I actually have learned so much and, you know, mostly from life's body blows, but stuff about health, about careers, about money, about dying, about relationships. I thought I need to write this. And, you know, within a year I had written this book and published it. And it's largely about the kind of what life is offering us when it comes along. What I thought I would do, I've actually still got quite a lot of copies of this book, and it's, you know, I've stopped selling it now. So what I've got is all in reserve. If any of you would like one, I'm giving them away. So just drop your name and your office and I'll make sure you get one. And then the last book I wrote was The Oceanus, which was a story that I thought was too good not to be shared. And I didn't want the story to die of old age. It's now, you know, 30 years old, the story, but it is truly a wonderful, wonderful story. And I thought that's what I'm going to share. And, you know, there's another book coming up, which I will write as soon as I retire. So I think my parting message is befriend elephants. And what I mean by that is, you know, older people do tend to know quite a lot and have amazing memories. I have a client called Warren Clulow. He's 88 now. He was the chairman of what was then Barlow Rand, became Barlow World. And he's been amazing in business. He's the biggest sugar farmer in KZN. And he and my father were friends. And Warren calls in at my office once a month, once every 2 months. We have a cup of coffee and a good chat. I visit him on his farm from time to time. And it's just, I just learn a fortune just from hanging out with this guy about, you know, his life's philosophies, about what he's done and where he's come from. And, you know, if you aren't already friendly with an elephant, find one. That's it from me. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Andy, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. I mean, that's gone beyond what we could ever have imagined into life lessons. But there were so many things that I feel resonate with me, but have also pulled through the series of talks we've had, and that is the finding solutions, being persistent, always being curious, making yourself a thought leader in your chosen area and the trusted advisor. And obviously I'm going to hop onto the sharing knowledge piece, because that is obviously critical to what we do in KM. So thank you so much. I would like to open the floor. Please, if anybody has any questions for Andy, this is really your opportunity.
Hi, Andy. My name's Annelia. I recently joined the Cape Town office from another law firm. The question I have is, and you've kind of alluded it, is how do you fit everything in? I've got a family. I really enjoy my work, but I also exercise and then got interests and friendships in that. And I'm honestly batting with that a bit at the moment. So I would appreciate some thoughts.
Great question, Anli. And it's, you know, it's something that I've wrestled with, and I'm sure we all do, especially when you're selling time. To me, the answer lies in a couple of places, and one is setting boundaries. You know, when I lived in Luxembourg, our first child was born, and there was a thing in that office where people would work till 9 or 10 at night. And I just said, I'm not doing that. And, you know, it cost me some of my relationship with my boss, but I said, 6:30, I'm going home, and I will go home at lunchtime as well and see my child. And I could do that. It was 5 minutes away, and it was fine. But, you know, but I was in early, and so that was one thing. I just had a non-negotiable boundary, unless there was a, you know, closing or something that had to happen. You know, then my wife understood it. If I said, you know, this is unavoidable. And to this day, that still happens. You know, when the Oceanus sank, I promise you, I was on the go for something like 20 hours a day. And that was for 3 weeks, flat out. And, you know, then it tapered off a bit. But, you know, and she was bringing up two young kids and trying to, you know, hold down a job herself. And there will be exceptions, but ultimately you need to say, what are my priorities? You know, what am I going to sacrifice, if I can go back to that term? And what is the cost to me, and so on? But it's prioritizing, it's setting time for yourself. Say, I will, come what may, I will organize some exercise 4 times a week or 5 times a week, and it'll happen at this hour on this day in this manner. And, you know, unless you're absolutely organized and disciplined and committed to each of those things, you've got to do it. The other place, you know, is find time by giving up the social media, giving up the stuff that wastes time. And you may have seen one of those time matrices, you know, where you've got things that are urgent, things that are important, things that are not urgent, not important, and, you know, which block does a thing fit into. But once you fit stuff into the matrix, you start prioritizing what really matters. And if your family really matters, then that's where you've got to put your energy. But ultimately, we each have a sort of hierarchy of values. And, you know, for some of us, the value, you know, we place our highest value on money. Another person might place a higher value on family and so on. But we each have a hierarchy of values, and you need to act in terms of that hierarchy and what really matters to you. But yeah, finding balance is important, but part of it is setting targets and setting priorities and setting boundaries.
David, go ahead.
Henry, thanks so much for the talk. It was really inspiring. The way you describe your entry into maritime law is almost stumbling into it. But the passion for it seems to have come a bit later. Is that do you think an accurate statement? And do you think it's something that you grew to love, or were you intentional about starting to love it when you realized you were good at it, or was it just the right time, right place?
David, I mean, that's very perceptive. No, you're quite right. I'd started doing the odd sort of marine insurance claim when I was at Web Eventsel, and I enjoyed it. So I did want to explore that a bit more. And when the opportunity came, you know, I grabbed it with both hands. But I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for. But when I arrived in London and started open my first, you know, 3 foot thick case of rice shortage, I thought, I don't know how any human being can do something like this, you know, sort of figure out where the rice got lost. But I started learning more about what maritime law is about. And there was just no doubt in my mind at that time in London that that's where I needed to be. So yes, I, you know, it was sort of more by luck than anything else that I found what excited me. You know, it just built on itself. You know, when I discovered what was possible in maritime law and where it could go, and it just grew and grew from that. But yeah, you're quite right. I did. It took a little while, but I was sort of on a path in insurance, which ultimately just led me there.
Thank you again, Andy. I really can't thank you enough.
Thanks, Sylvia. Thanks for joining.
If you would like to get in touch or find out more about Bowmans, please visit bowmanslaw.com.